The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but
we have made
engine
to start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Monday afternoon California time Space Show program. Great to be here. This is another gorgeous day in the San Francisco Bay Area in the heart of our rainy season. And I hope wherever you are, it's equally as nice and as inviting. A couple of very quick announcements. You can call us and talk with our guest, who I will introduce in a minute. Toll free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, we don't use any call screeners here, so be patient. Wait for us to answer the phone, and then be patient again, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can still send us email using drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember, we're copyrighted and trademarked, but we do give out blanket permission to download, copy these shows, spread them around. They're on a highly compressed MP3 format. And help get the word out, because space is important and has benefits for all of us, not just those of us living in a spacefaring country like the United States. So share the wealth, so to speak, and you do have our permission to do that. But in the process, don't do anything commercial. No show edits, no private YouTube channels, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. We're podcasting, of course. You can find all of our podcasting through gigadial.net, and the RSS URLs are on our website. You can easily listen to these shows on Zoom and iTunes and a host of other places. If you have any problems, do let me hear from you. I do my best to answer all of your emails and to hopefully help you resolve the problems, but no guarantees, because most of the technology is way beyond my pay grade. But again, I will do everything I can to help out if you do have a podcasting question or issue. Our website is thespaceshow.com, so we put our comprehensive newsletter up in the evening on Sunday. Everything is there in detail, the guest bios, the content of the coming programs for the week, and it's the only place where we have a future events section describing what's ahead for the Space Show. And then if we have to modify the program during the week or change anything, you're going to see it there first. So do check it out. Everything we do is archived, and so you can download right off of our website all of the programs. About, what is this? This one is 1727, going back to 2001, or you can listen right off of our website, either one, whichever way works best for you. There's a guest search tool on our website. I've been talking about that a lot. Hope you use it. If you have any questions about how to use it, please send me an email. There's a store on our site. You'll see it up at the top, called Space Show Gear. And then above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation Incorporated, and we only exist because of your gifts and generosity. We thank you very much for that. And do remember that if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you do get a deduction on your taxes. If you're a California taxpayer, you get the same for your taxes here in California. Check with your advisors about other states. I simply don't know what happens in another state. And then I do want to remind everybody that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. They're also the sponsors of our webinar series. For more information, visit the Secure World Foundation .org. And I'm very happy to tell you about our guest today and to bring back, after a couple of years, Jay Barbary. He is NBC's veteran space correspondent. When I say veteran, he's the only correspondent to have watched, witnessed, and reported every single one of our space shuttle flights. every one of them. The NBC space unit won an Emmy for its coverage of the first Apollo moon landing. Jay also broke the world's news exclusive on the cause of the Challenger explosion. He is co-author of the New York Times bestseller Moonshot, and this book is back with us in ebook format. We'll talk about that during our program today. He also has a terrific book, which was the subject of the last time he was on the space show, Live from Cape Canaveral, covering the space race from Sputnik to today. And I'll tell you, if you really want to know the inside history of those early years of the space race and what was going on, this is the book that you want to read, and it still is available. Jay, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you?
Thanks for having me back, David. I'm wonderful. Thank you. Still sitting down here behind my bush at the Cape and trucking right along 54 years with NBC and signed a new contract for another 5 years. And I was asked the other day by a reporter. They said, now, when that contract's up, I said, that'll be October the 2nd, 2016. They said, are you finally going to retire then? And I said, well, I'll be 82. That might be a nice place to consider a career change. So anyway.
Well, we may still have people on the space station in 5 years, so they're going to have to renew you for another 5 years.
There you go. That'll do it. I'll mention that to them, David.
What did you think when you saw that last shuttle lift off from the Cape? I mean, could you actually believe that that program was coming to an end?
Well, I could, and I had real mixed emotions about it because Ryan Williams anchored the show out of New York, and he came to me for the launch, and so did all the other NBC networks like MSNBC and the Weather Channel and all, and we did the actual launch for him. And as you mentioned, that was actually the 135th mission for the space shuttle, and we had done 31 before in the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program, and starting with Alan Shepard's first launch on May the 5th, 1961. In fact, as you mentioned, Moonshot, Alan Shepard was my co-author on that, or I should say I was his co-author in the sense that it was by Alan and Deke Slayton, and I was the guy who kind of strung the words together. But anyway, you know, we covered them all, and I had different feelings about all of them. We just celebrated the 50th anniversary of John Glenn's first flight into orbit by an American. And I think of all the 166, I was talking the other day, David, I think possibly Glenn's launch on board that Atlas that had the history of blowing up as much as it did flying, and he got on top of it. That was probably the most exciting of all the 166, even more so than the launch of Apollo 11 to the moon.
Only because of the risk involved, or why?
I think that's it. And the fact that we were definitely behind the Russians and we were trying to catch up, of course. You know, a lot of people didn't quite understand why we were there. Well, the only reason why we were behind the Russians was that we didn't have a regime in Washington that cared about space. They thought it was, back in those days, the guy in charge was not President Eisenhower. The Defense Department guy, Secretary E. Wilson, he was talking about it was a stunt. He thought putting a satellite in orbit was a stunt, and they didn't want to worry about it. And they were participating in the IGY program with Vanguard, but outside of that, they didn't care what happened. But the main reason, and I know you know, David, but the main reason why the Russians put such large payloads up as they did in the very beginning, and here we are putting these small, puny satellites up, was simply that we needed 360,000 pounds of thrust out on Atlas to carry our nuclear warheads 5,000 miles in intercontinental ranges, and the Russians needed 900 to a million pounds of thrust to carry their huge warheads, not nearly as sophisticated and small and transistorized as ours were, to their target. So that's why we had a difference between rockets that could launch and the payloads that they could launch. But when John Glenn went into orbit, we sort of like, well, thought, well, we're catching up a little bit here, even though Titov had already circled the globe for 24 hours, and here we were going up for three orbits. And I want to point out something. I pointed out to Jim Behnke the other day, and he said, you know, as much as Jim Behnke is a real authority, but he didn't know this. And a lot of people don't know this, and maybe your space audience would like to know. When John Glenn went into orbit, he went into orbit for three orbits. The destroyer NOAA was the recovery ship at the end of the third orbit. And as also you know, David, when you're in orbit, 90 minutes going around, the Earth rotates 1,500 miles beneath this orbit each time. So if you come over a point over the Atlantic Ocean where you'd like to have a recovery ship, and then you come over an orbit later, it has moved 1,500 miles. So when Glenn went into orbit, they burned the absolute last second of fuel that they had for the thrust to get there, and they were afraid they weren't even going to get enough energy to actually get into orbit. But after they got into orbit, the computer told them that they had, computers being what they were in 1962, told them that they had enough speed and inclination to the equator and all the parameters to stay in orbit seven orbits. So they told Glenn, you're good for at least seven orbits. Well, when they did that, everybody assumed that he would, not everybody, because people that knew the difference didn't assume it, but most listeners thought, well, he's going to stay up there seven orbits. No, he was never planned to stay up there seven orbits. It's just that he had the orbital parameters to do it had they wanted to, because they wanted to bring him down to his recovery location where the destroyer NOAA was waiting. So the whole plan from the get-go was three orbits, and that's what he flew. He simply just got into orbit on an orbit good enough to last for seven orbits.
I don't remember ever hearing that before, so that is new.
Well, they tell him just as he goes into orbit, and people constantly write about it, but they say, you have a go for seven orbits. Okay. That was the exact language, if I remember it word for word. And he, Friendship 7, you have a go for seven orbits. And he acknowledged that. And so by the language, you have a go for seven orbits, they thought that Mercury Control meant that he would be flying for seven orbits. No, they meant he would stay in orbit if you did nothing for at least seven orbits before you'd start decaying. but anyway, there has been so much written on that, and I read in a lot of books that John Glenn's flight was cut short.
It was never cut short.
It was never cut short. It was intended to be three orbits, and that was it. You know.
You got to meet all of these early astronauts, and probably many of the later newer astronauts. Is there a difference in their spirit, or can you say that there's a difference in any way whatsoever between the Alan Shepherds and people like that and what we have today?
Great difference.
Really?
And yes, great difference. And I'm not putting down the astronauts today. The people, the original Mercury 7, were test pilots. They were also had to have an engineering degree. They also had to be married. And these guys were the best at doing what they did. And David, they thought that these people might go blind in orbit, that the size of their eyeballs would change. And there were so many what we would consider ridiculous, predictable things that might happen to them in space. And they really didn't know. That's why von Braun insisted on flying a chimpanzee before. Had they not flown the chimpanzee, Ham, then Alan Shepard would have been the first in space. And had they not flown another test flight, he would have been the first in space. He, in our book, you know, both in Moonshot and also in Live from Cape Canaveral, you find the details on this. But again, they didn't know. Well, these guys climbed on board these rockets. They went out there and they kicked them with their feet and walked all over them and made sure that they were okay. Like, for example, Sam Bedingfield, the NASA engineer that put most of them in the spacecraft. He was an aeronautical engineer brought down from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base by Gus Grissom. Gus had been stationed there and knew Sam Bedingfield and wanted Sam here for the space program. And he called Sam up and he said, Sam, come down here and help us get into space. And Sam says, Gus, I don't know anything about space flight. I'm an aeronautical guy, you know. And Gus says, well, Sam, none of us do. You know, come on down. We're going to learn as we go. So this is the situation that you had. You had these people learning, and Gus gave his life, and you know all the rest of the history of things that happened. And today, the astronauts that you have today are, again, the very best that we have, but they are educated and brought here to fly in space knowing pretty much what's going to happen. It's like the first guys that learned to fly, like Orville and Wilbur Wright, and those guys, they had to teach one another, learn for themselves, and it's compare Orville and Wilbur with airline pilots today. That's what you're talking about. You're talking about people that are great people, dedicated people, but well-educated for the profession that they're in.
So the private sector guys that have gone up to the space station and the people who want to fly on the Virgin Galactic, would you equate them to the early astronauts in any way?
Of course not.
Because some people,
of course not.
Well, some people do.
Now let's go back to what you're going to do as far as people paying to take a trip up to 60 miles and come back down, you know, not go into orbit, but just to go up and come back down. Is that what you're talking about?
Out
in the desert.
Yeah, that's my question. Other than
that's
the ones
fuel
that
ride. It is not, and there's nothing wrong with it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not putting it down. These guys are good people, and God bless them. I hope they're tremendously successful. But when you start talking about the people that go up today and they live on the International Space Station and the people who are still visionaries that are talking about we need to fly into deep space, go back to the moon, beyond the moon, to the Lagrange points, to the asteroids, out to Mars, you know, these people are the real pioneers. Because, see, what most people don't realize, David, and I want everybody to listen very carefully to this, we are all astronauts. David and Jay now are flying along on a spacecraft called Earth. It's 8,000 miles in diameter. It has about 10,000 feet of life support systems on it. It's traveling around a star called the Sun by us at 66,000 miles per hour. And we moved through this around the sun every 365 days, and because we were hit back in about 50 to 150 million years at the beginning of the solar system, our solar system, we were hit by a Mars-sized planet that knocked us off of our axis and spun us up, and it gives us the seasons and everything that we need here on Earth that we do. But after all, it's finite. One day, we're going to have to leave our spacecraft, and if we are to survive, we got to be able to go somewhere else. And the thing is, most will tell you that we got another 4.5 billion years before we lose the solar system. Doesn't mean we got 4.5 billion years on this planet. There's so many things that could go wrong as it is, and we had a asteroid that came through nearby within the moon's orbit back, I don't know, several months ago. I don't remember. They would have taken this Earth out. There's one out there now headed that would take it out in the year 2040. Now, of course, we should have the equipment and the know-how to go out there and deflect this asteroid. We've got these people who are doing all this tracking, but people just don't realize what the threat is. So if we are to survive as a species, and we're one of the youngest species on this planet, but if we're to survive as a species, we've got to be able to go elsewhere. And, of course, the natural place that we should go first is back to the moon. And I've been talking to Dr. Gene McCall, who is a Princeton physicist, who is a fellow and a senior scientist at Los Alamos for many years, but for 10 years or so he was the chief scientist of the Air Force Space Command. And we've been looking at the possibility. Some people have thought about taking the International Space Station. After all, we paid, what, $500 billion up there to put that up there.
Yeah,
we've got
a lot
all
of money.
Great equipment and everything up there in Earth orbit. Well, if we're going to be through with it in 2020, and then we're going to try to guide it back to a death in the Pacific Ocean, and Dr. McCall and other people right now are working on an assignment trying to come up to how to predict different masses that are coming through the atmosphere, how far will they float, what will be their exact trajectory, etc., where they can know when something is going to re-enter and where it's going to wind up. But you've got a huge amount of equipment up there in that International Space Station, so they said, why do we want to bring it back and crash it on Earth? Some say, why don't we go and put it at the Attican crater on the basin on the south pole of the moon? Well, that's great, but that is also a big problem and would probably cost more to do it than it would be worth. And where we're trying to do things on the cheap and with other nations involved and everything for the future here, why not take the International Space Station, and I'm going to write about this. It'll be on MSNBC in the next more details on the series I'm doing called Getting to Mars. But why not take the space station? You put a nuclear engine on it that will give you constant thrust that you need to move it to the orbital plane of the moon, because it's not there now. It's inclined at 52 degrees or almost 52 degrees, which takes it over Russia's ports as well as our own ports. But we can get it around to the plane of the moon and then send it into a figure eight around the moon and back. It would take about every 10 days it would go around. Now, what would that do for you? First of all, you're learning on the International Space Station, the crew up there, how to work in space. But you're not learning how to travel in space. Primarily because these people are still under the protection of Earth's magnetosphere, protection from solar and galactic radiation. So this is your biggest problem if you're going to travel out to asteroids or if you're going to travel out to Mars. Your biggest problem is dealing with this. They're looking at a generator, the small company right south of us here at Palm Bay. It's looking on setting up your own magnetic field within your spacecraft, electrical, that will keep the radiation away so that you don't absorb too much radiation, you know, as a crew. Well, when you leave the magnetosphere of the Earth here and you go around the moon and back, then you're working out into deep space, where the same situation that you would be in if you're traveling out to an asteroid or to Mars. And so anyway, you will be able to learn how to travel. There's so much that you can do. And it's not, would not be implausible to be able to take the spacecraft that we have today. That would take, it takes us up to the space station and back. That we can't continue to do that to the space station and back, but add a landing stage and on the moon and a launching stage, and be able to launch from the moon and back and join the space station as it comes over around the moon again. So, I mean, there's just so many things that you could do, and look what you got. You got it very cheap, wouldn't cost all that much, using existing equipment, and do everything within budget, yet do all the great science that you need, and that would be the natural first step to do before you venture out to asteroids and out to Mars. And so anyway, there's a lot of it going on now, and I know I'm getting far afield on this.
Well, actually, you're really not, because this is what we end up talking about on most shows right now, is that all of this stuff seems so far out because of problems within our policy right now of doing most anything.
Well, that's right. Well, I mean, the problem is that we're out of bucks.
Yeah, we're out of money.
And so if you can, why in the world would you throw away something you paid $500 billion for? I mean, you can continue to update this and you can use it. What you can't do is that you can't go blast it off, you know, under heavy thrust off to the moon, because that would rip it apart.
Well,
you have to have real slow acceleration and continuous thrust to take you up where you want to go and get into this figure eight orbit of the moon and the Earth. And you can do it with the existing nuclear engines. You can almost do it with the ATV that I think that Dr. McCall was talking about, the ATV from the European Space Agency. But what you need here is not so much thrust as you need the continuous thrust. And your continuous thrust you're going to get from a desktop-sized nuclear rocket.
So how do we get I do lots of shows on advocating the nuclear rocket. How do we get a nuclear rocket going? Maybe you have the magic silver bullet idea.
Aerojet, they picked up, I'm trying to remember the name of the program, it won't come to me right now, and Dr. McCall worked on it right afterwards at Los Alamos. And it goes back to the 90s. And I think Aerojet General took over that, and they've done some good stuff. I saw some stuff on it not too far long ago. And if you're going to go to Mars right now, that's the existing system you're going to have to go. And people, if you say nuclear, they go, oh, you know, I mean, it's just ridiculous because was born on a farm in South Georgia with kerosene lamps. And it was so funny. I was asked not too long ago. I'm 78 years old. I was born on November the 26th, 1933, to write about what happened at my birth. Well, my mother was a farm woman with five children. I was number six. And she was cooking what they call dinner, which is their midday meal. And my older brother and father was in the field working. And I decided to come in the world, and she just barely made it to the bed. And she had herself and a 23-month-old toddler. And she managed to get one leg up on the bed, and I came into this world. And when my six-year-old sister came back in, she was big enough that my mother could send her to the field to get my father and my brother and to go get a midwife. You didn't have 911 to call. She didn't have a phone. She had nothing. The luxury for a birth in 1933 on the farm was a midwife. You were in high cotton if you had a midwife. And at that time, my father was on the board of education for the county that we lived in. And he was constantly trying to get electricity out to our farm. But every farmer on the route out there were afraid of it. They thought it would burn their house down. And they were, oh, no, you can't have that stuff. It'll kill you. Just like people are insanely, you know, crazy about nuclear energy today, because when you think about what we had open fireplaces and kerosene lamps, and we were worried about electricity burning our clapboard houses down. I would have been a lot more worried about kerosene lamps, you know,
and
fires in the fireplace. But anyway, it's just unjustified that they worry about this nuclear, and we've been using nuclear on board ships for how many years without any major problems? And the only one that they keep citing again was the breakdown at, what was it, Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania or something? Nobody was killed there. It's not rational, the fear that's there. Now, to use a nuclear engine with a desktop reactor to go to buy in this figure eight would be easy enough, but if you use it to go to Mars, you're carrying the power with you, because once you get out to Mars, you need much larger solar panels to use solar electricity out there, but you're carrying your own power with you. And also, you know, there's three or four other things that would work in there that would help. I don't want to sound like I'm a physicist. I'm not, you know. But I write so much on this stuff, and working with these people who do know, who do answer my questions, you know. And so anyway, this right now, if you want to go to Mars, this is the only propulsion system that you got that you can. And the point is that we don't know yet how to go to Mars. And to learn how to go to Mars, we need to be able to have a flight out of the magnetosphere of this planet and to set up these things that we need. And This would be a first step in a figure eight orbit around the moon and the Earth with your International Space Station, and possibly landing part of it on the moon. Of course, Attican Crater is the great place to do that. And I'm sure you're familiar with all the studies that have been made there, because you go from the height of temperature on the lunar surface to the coldest on the lunar surface in the permanent shadows, where you have so much water that's there now and ice. So anyway, we won't go any further than that, but that would be the logical place to set up a human colony. And you would do it over 100 years. You wouldn't do it, you wouldn't try to do it as Speaker Gingrich said, by the time of his term. And I got a big laugh out of this. He has a PhD from Tulane University, but his science was right. His timing was just a little off. And the rest of them, when you talk to them about it, they're, well, we're going to appoint another committee to study it. Well, my Lord, David, we've been studying this space program now for 8 years, and we finally got a commitment with the SLS and with the commercial side of space now. We got some people working on this and some programs going. And what we don't need at the end of this election is another stoppage, because we lost 9,000 good, hard-working people right here at the Cape. Over this last 3 or 4 years, we lost them. They're gone after shuttle and everything, and we just can't have that again. Well, that's the death knell of the space program.
You have a caller who wants to talk to you. Let's see who it is.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the program with Jay Barbary. Who are you, please?
Bill Rowe.
Oh, Dr. Rowe. Welcome. Always good to hear from you. How are you?
Fine. Jay, I wondered about using the International Space Station and using it to go to the moon. What about the risk of solar storms from the moon? How much of a logistic problem might that be?
Well, Dr. Rowe, you're the man who could answer this. Incidentally, this is Dr. Rowe, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of yours, and I know you've been talking to my friend, Dr. McCall. But I've read a lot of your stuff, and you can answer those questions, because I'm not,
I think you might have the wrong Dr. Rowe. I'm not a physicist. I'm in medicine, and I don't know Dr. McCall.
Okay. Well, there's the R-O-W-E.
Yeah, you've got the wrong Dr. Rowe.
Okay, good. Yeah, but he is a physicist, and he worked with Dr. McCall at
you got the wrong guy.
Okay, you weren't out there. You weren't out there, and he worked on the NERVA program and all. That's who I thought I was talking to.
No.
Yeah. But anyway, what was your question again, sir?
How much risk might there be with the problem with solar storms? If you send solar storms, I don't know how often they occur, but the radiation from the solar storm from the moon could be appreciable, and if you've got an International Space Station there, I wonder how complicated that might be from a logistics standpoint.
This is why you should do it, because first of all, those solar storms, the radiation from the solar storms, we're protected. The astronauts are protected by the Earth's magnetosphere. So you're going to go out of the magnetosphere where you lose this protection, and you're going to be out, say, they're talking about 10 days now to do one figure eight. So I don't know. I'm just guessing off the top of my head. So maybe 6 of those 10 days, you're outside exposed to the radiation from solar storms. Of course, the Apollo astronauts were also, and they had to keep up with the amount of radiation that they were absorbing. Now, that's why you need to do this. You need to come up with an onboard system that this company is working on here at Palm Bay, Florida, that creates its own magnetosphere, its own magnet that will protect the inside, the people inside and all from this radiation. Or you could use water. That would do it. But, again, that carries a lot of weight. But this is the type of thing that you need to study, and this is why I'm saying we don't know how to go to Mars today. And one of the biggest problems is solar and galactic radiation. So this is why we should do that, exactly why we should do that. Now, if you start building a community in Attican Basin on the south pole of the moon, of course, there you would have from radiation, they've got plenty of dirt, and you could build, you know, to protect yourself there, you could build that. But again, if you're ever going to go out to Mars, and if you about the quickest you can get out there is about 9 months, the way I understand it now, under nuclear propulsion, you're still going to have to protect yourself from radiation. So you can't carry all the water, I wouldn't think, to do it. That would be humongous. But again, on the other hand, this is what we've got to develop. And we have to learn how to fly in space. And I can't tell you because I'm not a physicist, but there are a lot of smart people around that can come up with the wrong answers when we're looking at doing this, and this is an orderly development that should take place.
Well, when during the Apollo missions, NASA measured the radiation on the moon, and they emphasized the fact that other than during a solar storm, the radiation on the moon was not appreciable.
Mm-hmm.
But my concern again
they
is
also,
solar storms.
They also,
I don't know how solar storms. I don't know how often they occur.
Yeah. Well, what they were predicted. They're predictable storms. But NASA, I do know, a couple of times held up of sending astronauts to the moon because of an anticipated solar storm to allow that to pass at that time. So I don't remember. It's just one of the many things that were going on. I covered all of the missions, but I just remember that's happening, and everybody was concerned about it and wore their own detectors and how much they absorbed and all. And there's been some talk since these guys come back. For example, Alan Shepard died of leukemia.
Yeah.
And Alan Shepard, his father and mother both lived into their 90s. And Alan was 10 years older than I am. He would be 88 if he was alive today. But there's some people would want to tell you that did his leukemia, did going to the moon. He took the longest walk on the moon, he and Edgar Mitchell. And going up there, did that contribute to it? Now, I don't know.
Probably
you're a medical
not.
Doctor, you might have some ideas.
Probably not. It was too short of a period of time, I would think.
Right. That's what most people, what most people say. It was a short period of time. But going out to Mars and back is not short. Going out to an asteroid for 6-7 weeks and coming back is not too short. So this is what some of the problems that you got to get around and what you got to learn how to do. And you got to come up with the means to do it. And right now what they're looking at is to carry along your own magnets, set up your own magnetic field around the vehicle that you're in, and if you go nuclear and you carry a desk-size nuclear reactor, I'm told, then of course you've got your energy on Mars while you're there, and also when you come back. So you're essentially carrying your own power plant with you.
Well, thank you very, very much. Appreciate it. Interesting talking to you and listening to you.
Thank you, Bill.
Well, thank you, sir, and thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Listeners, our line is available, 866-687-7223. You have an email from Jeff, who is in Cincinnati, and Jeff says the moon program has been canceled. In fact, all of the destination programs are canceled. It's not just that we don't have any money. We're not doing very much in space. So how do we get back to doing something like your moon plan, even if money is tight?
Well, first of all, Jim, is it?
Jeff.
Jim, you're absolutely correct, 98%. When they came up with the SLS, this is the heavy lift rocket system, the whole projection by Congress and by the Obama administration is to return to deep space. That's what that is for. So you have destinations already pointed out to be asteroids. They want to try to do that in 2026. That's sort of where they're aiming, going to Mars maybe in the 2030s. This is what we have to be concerned about, that we've got this commitment back by the Congress and by the executive branch, that this isn't suddenly canceled by a new administration and then have another committee to study it for another year, because that would be the rest of the people working in the program gone, because the space program cannot sustain another investigation by a bunch of people pointing into the air and not really with different ideas and different ways that we want to go. I tell you what the biggest problem is in the space program is that you've got so many interests from different people, from different companies and different government agencies, that they're all looking at it for their own self-interest rather than looking at it for the interest of the human species. And I look at it from the standpoint and feel it should be that, for example, if we're going to Mars, I feel like it should be a consortium of nations to sustain the cost of doing so. But it also is a means in which, like, since we started flying with the Russians and going to the Russians' Mir space station, and then the Russians becoming a partner in the International Space Station, and we have also Canada, and we have Japan, and we have 11 nations from Europe, 15 nations totally. We've got everybody in this group that is cooperating with one another. The flight of the Apollo Soyuz in July 1975, where Tom Stafford and Deke Slayton went up, and Vance Brann, and they docked up there with General Leonov, who was the first to walk in space, and Kubrasov, his engineer. That happened in space, and since then, we have had cooperation between the Soviet Union and Russia and America that we never, and it's a friendship that has grown from this, that has opened doors between the two countries today. And no one really considers Russia the enemy they once were or fear them, because we're operating the space station together and all of that. So it's a good foundation to keep things working and humming along on the planet as well as up there in space. And it's a good thing to have. And I see it in terms of something similar going to Mars or ever building any sort of colony on the moon. But yes, there is a program, the SLS, Space Launch System, which is essentially what the old Constellation program was that Bush set up, that is going to build a heavy lift vehicle. We're working on an Orion spacecraft that will go out to deep space. Its first flight is late 2013 or early 2014, and its mission will be unmanned, and it will go 5,000 miles out in space and return through the Earth's atmosphere at about 25,000 miles per hour, the speed in which it would return from the moon or from deep space. In fact, I'm going out for a tour, and the operation building out here where they're building it, they're putting it together, they got it set up, part of the stuff is in. I'm getting a tour Thursday afternoon. So I'm going to go out there and start seeing what they're putting together. But there is money being spent by NASA for building the heavy lift rocket. And there are contracts that are underway on it and the Orion spacecraft. And the Orion spacecraft is being built by Lockheed Martin out of Denver. And it will carry up to 7 people. It's essentially a big spacecraft, like twice, a third, or 4 times as big as the Apollo. But it's an Apollo-type spacecraft.
So what do you say to the folks within our community who are adamantly and voicefully, I mean, that's not the right word, but expressing themselves with loud voices in opposition to SLS?
Well, let me say this to you. Now, I see, and this is strictly my own observance, David, is that I see over here on the far right, I see people screaming, don't spend another nickel. Okay? We're in deep debt. We got to stop right here. We cannot spend any more money. We're out of money. We can't borrow any more money. Yet I see over here on the extreme left, now you're talking to an independent.
Yeah.
As a reporter, I've always been an independent. I believe a reporter should be an independent. I'm not a member of the Democrat Party or the Republican Party or the Libertarian or any of them. Okay? I'm a pretty independent guy. Anyway, over here on the far left, you've got we have a right to everything. You got to buy everything for us. The government has to pay us a living. We only work on the jobs that we want to work in. And you got to do this and that. And yeah, from the moment I'm born, you got to take care of me all the way to the grave. And I got entitled to this, entitlements, entitlements, entitlements. Okay? So you see that in Greece a lot going on today. Now, I'm sitting back looking that if a person from the Republican Party is elected president this fall, that is going to do the extreme of killing every program like SLS and stopping everything and not spending any money. You think you've seen heartache on this world, on this planet, in this country? You ain't beginning to see it, because everybody is for stop spending until it comes to them. You go gore the other guy's ox. Don't you touch my ox.
Absolutely.
Okay? Now,
yeah.
That's the mindset of everybody. But, buddy, I mean, you should cancel every program but mine. You know? Now, you go over here and you do it the other way. So what would be the logical, sensible thing to do? It would be to get back to a balanced budget, but it would have to be done over a few years. You need to keep things moving. You should need to keep spending in check, but programs like what is being spent on NASA, because we did a piece, and I think you said you had it on your desk a while ago, about all the benefits that we have gotten, especially in medicine, from the space program. And people do not realize that they have this because we went to the moon in the space program. They walk around and think these smartphones and all of this great technology they have today just suddenly came in on the wind. It was never developed. We never got where we are there. And if we don't use common sense in this and approach this with common sense, because we could do this. We could bring the United States of America back in check over several years, cut down on our spending, bring it back, pass the laws, whatnot, to do this, and without throwing a lot of people out of work. But you ain't seen nothing yet if you start saying we're going to cut $5 trillion next year. And that's got to come from somewhere, and that's got to come from an awful lot of jobs. And the people are going to be walking around, and they're not going to have anything, and you think it is bad now. And we've just gone through a lot of people losing their jobs. And I'll tell you, my daughter, my oldest daughter, she's now 50 years old. She started working in this program 27 years ago. She's a single mother grandmother. She worked for 26 years, and she was one of the 9,000 that lost her job. She's been out of work now for over a year. She's got some possibility with this SLS program of getting back a full-time job like she had in the space program, because she's very good at what she does. She's very qualified at what she does, and she's got a chance of getting back. But if we have another committee that's going to study this, no one has a chance of getting back. And those who would want to cancel SLS and cancel everything else and say, we don't need to do that and of all of that, the time comes that we have an asteroid in 2040 hurtling down on this planet going to do as much damage or more than what happened 65 million years ago when we lost the dinosaurs and all that, hurtling down on this planet, and we don't have the know-how or the rocketry or the people to go up and deflect that asteroid, then the same people are going to be screaming, why did you cancel the space program? The very same people.
You have another caller. Let's bring yes. this caller in. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Oh, this is Jerry Everett in Meriden.
Okay.
Hi, Mr. Barbary. It's good to hear from you. I listened to you on the TV for many, many years.
Thank you, sir.
I'm fascinated with the idea of the putting the space station in a figure eight shuttle orbit around the moon. I can think of one thing that's in the favor of it. The Ad Astra Corporation has the VX-200 Vashner engine that was to be placed on the space station in 2014.
Uh-huh.
And some of the parts are already up there.
Right.
But I understand due to budgetary considerations, it's going to be delayed.
Mm-hmm.
But that engine is exactly what you're talking about. It's not nuclear, but if we use the solar panels that are already on the station for power, and it would be used to basically for station keeping to keep it in orbit rather than to have the progress of it and drag and give it an occasional boost.
Mm-hmm.
Use argon gas to that would be a cheaper way for station keeping. If you provided additional argon gas, it could also put you into that figure eight orbit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it doesn't need a lot of development. Flight hardware is in Houston being tested.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect in favor of it.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of things that would be a problem with it is that, of course, getting people onto the space station in that orbit, of course, you'd have to match velocity with it.
It's not like
you would be launching something into low Earth orbit. Mm-hmm. You'd have to be going a good proportion of the speed of getting to the moon to get anything onto the space station.
Mm-hmm.
And also, during the time that you spend in the Van Allen belt, the radiation that you'd be experiencing would be as though you were in a solar storm.
Right.
Now you pass through it, but you'd be passing through it twice in each year eight orbit.
Yeah, that's
I was unaware of the people
you've got to come up with a way to protect yourself from that.
I was unaware of the people working at Pond Bay, but I know about electrostatic protection, and that's something to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be cheaper to just get a Bigelow BA-330 and use it as the shuttle.
I don't know. It might be. You got to remember, I'm a reporter and not a very good one probably, but at least I've been around a while, doing it. And I know the people like yourself to talk to, to find, but I can't answer that question, but that might be enough itself. What the people that I'm talking to now are thinking about.
Yeah.
Is we already have it there. We already have these systems there. We already have these modules there, and we can put it into this. And you're talking about being able to get stuff on board, because when the station comes back around the Earth, I assume it would be traveling around 25,000 miles per hour going back out again. But when you get to the moon, it would be traveling about 4,000 miles an hour.
Right.
And so if you wanted to put people on board or something like that, you might be better to use the Orion spacecraft and actually intercept it at a speed. Now, when you get to the Lagrange point between Earth and the moon, you're traveling then a little over 2,000 miles per hour. So there are points along that you could select to dock with them. And do this, that you wouldn't have to hop on board at 25,000 miles an hour here. There are different points, but all of this is very workable. All of this could be done, and it's the type of thing as what is being learned now on what was learned on Mir, what's in Skylab, what's being learned on the International Space Station now is great. How to work in space, but you're not learning. How do I travel in deep space? Which means my biggest problem is radiation, solar and galactic. So what you're bringing up here, you're going through the Van Allen radiation belt twice on each trip. And, of course, the guys did it going out on Apollo, and coming back. So you do get that twice like on Apollo, but if you're doing this every 10 days, you're getting it twice every 10 days for 6 months if you stay on board for 6 months, or whatever you do, or where you get off, or, you know, all of that is workable. And it has to be done, and you've got all of that equipment up there, and it's all, it seems to me it would be a heck of a lot easier to keep that equipment working, updating, bringing up whatever you need, and so, and then it would be to try to build something. That's why the guys that wanted to soft crash the station into Attica Basin, you know, that is, that's bigger problem. But you would have this, all of this equipment there, and I don't know how soft the crash would be. Something I imagine like the balloons that we put on Mars. Of course, you got a little atmosphere on Mars. You have none on the moon. That landed our rovers there and everything. They bounced along for a while. I don't know. I'm not a physicist. I'm not a architect for NASA building this for them. But they do have the people that can work these problems out. And it just seems to me that if you're thinking along these lines, that you can come up with these things. And you can do things, and you can do them by using what you've got and by engaging other nations that want to be part of it. And that other engaging other nations, to me, is a double-edged sword. It helps you get along with your neighbor a lot better here on Earth if you're in business with him. You know. So anyway, enough said on that subject.
Anything else, Jerry?
Yeah, well, just if you wanted to soft crash it into Attica Basin there, I think that would be a major engineering project, but you could probably do a soft-ish crash fairly cheaply and easily, and then use the part or salvage the parts, because that's a lot of good parts and on a moon that doesn't have many, that's very expensive to get things to. So that might be a good idea.
Yeah, well, that's what these
I think with one of the things that that the Bigelow VA-330 could do for you is it's an American thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to work with a lot of partners.
Okay.
Thank you so much,
Jerry.
It was great talking to you.
A couple of emails are here for you. This is Anthony from England who is listening. Dear Jay, I have been enjoying listening to your ideas, but I wanted to make a comment in reaction to the mention of Newt Gingrich's space plan. One of my biggest pet peeves about how people, usually the media, interpret his speech is that they think his colony comment was related to his for a base. He said he wanted a base on the moon by 2020, not a colony. The colony thing was a separate comment, and he made no indication of how long he thought that would take to come to be. Again, this is my biggest pet peeve about the media's reaction to his comments, that they keep juggling the word colony and base as if they mean the same thing, which they don't.
Of course not. And Anthony, you are absolutely correct, and thank you for that comment. And this is what peeves me. It peeves me also, because I am totally convinced, I am no relation to Newt Gingrich, but I am totally convinced that he's the smartest man in any room he walks into, because he has more experience and he's on to everything. But again, on the other hand, the media first don't understand what the man is trying to say, and they don't like to have somebody from his spectrum of politics being that smart, I guess. So you have to, what you have to do is make him laughable. And this is their mission, is to make, in a lot of ways, to make the man laughable. But I talked to every presidential candidate down here that came down here in Florida, and I talked to every one of them, and Newt was the only one that really knew what was going on in the space program and had some sensible ideas how they could be done. But right now, where we are with the current administration, we have these programs after fighting tooth and nail for 3 to 4 years. We have them in place. We have the commercial program in place that's going along pretty well. We've got 4 people involved there that's going to take care of the low Earth orbit work. And then we've got this SLS program. And the space program needs that. It doesn't need to have someone come in and start studies all over again, because that would be the death knell of the program.
So we've said that enough, I think, David.
Okay. You got a Bill from Virginia. I know we got another caller on hold. You're a popular guy, but we're going to do the email, and the caller's just going to have to sit tight. So this is from Bill in Virginia, and he said, in anticipation of your being on the space show today, I went back and listened to the archive program when you were on several years ago. Very interesting. You had fabulous stories to tell, including some hilarious stories about specific things with the chimpanzees. I'm wondering if you know that, at least I read an article, so I'm assuming it's true, that PETA, our lovely animal protective agency, has decided that NASA should house a museum for the chimps and document the abuse that the chimps were put through in going to space, and then further commemorate this museum to stopping all sorts of other animal abuse in lab experiments. Have you covered this story? Is it a real story? Do you think there's any chance of NASA giving them unused space for this?
No, I don't think so. I haven't heard anything about this.
I read the story, too.
I know nothing about it, but... it wouldn't surprise me, but I don't think... I tell you what, the current NASA administrator, Charlie Bolden, is a great and wonderful guy. And his deputy, Lori Garver, is a great and wonderful deputy. And they're doing everything they possibly can. And I don't know if they will be entertain this thing, but you've got to listen to some of the craziest ideas that's ever had ever come along. Of course, I know that Alan Shepard and those guys who live next to those chimpanzees, the chimpanzee colonies, they lived in the astronaut quarters, that it got so bad with these chimpanzees howling and throwing dung at them and everything every time they walked by that they had to move to the local Holiday Inn on Cocoa Beach. And that's where they stayed. They got a $10 day per diem from NASA. And they talked the manager of the local Holiday Inn, Henry Landworth, into giving them a room for $1 a day. So they got to live off base because of that. So anyway, no, I know nothing about that at all, and I'm hoping it's not true.
Well, I read the story, too. That doesn't mean it's true or not. But, yes, PETA is PO'd that NASA abused the poor chimps.
Of course.
And, you know, what can I say? The chimps were heroes of our space program.
Well, of course they were. They did a great job, And the biggest hero, of course, was Enos, who every time that he did what he was supposed to, he got a shock. It got backwards. He came out of that spacecraft. He'd have nothing to do with anybody, and he was biting and fighting anybody that got close to him. But anyway, you know, there was a lot of things that happened on the early days as they did, and everything when you're trying to learn and you're trying to do the best you can do. And I think that's what we have to bear in mind. We're human beings, and we do the best we can do, most of us. It's never perfect.
If we track some of the problems you outlined, such as radiation, by possibly using the moon as a test bed, would you be in favor of one-way missions to Mars, or do you think we need to develop the infrastructure first so we can bring the crew back safely?
I'm all in favor of one-way missions to Mars. I'll tell you why. When the people boarded the wagon trains at St. Joe, Missouri, they knew they were going one way. When people got on the boats that came over from England to Plymouth Rock, they pretty well knew they were going one way. Some would go back. Some would return. But there would be absolutely nothing wrong with one-way trips to Mars if you put the structures on the Red Planet that they need, all the equipment and everything that they needed there when they got there, that they could keep this colony going and growing. And eventually the day would come, and I'm not talking about in 20 or 30 or 40 years, I'm talking in 200 or 300 years, would come that they would be flying back from Mars to here, and that you would have interplanetary flights. No, there's no reason, if it saves a lot of money,
because you could get all the volunteers that you could ever need for a one-way mission to Mars. There's nothing says it's got to be a round trip if that's what's stopping you.
You have another caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Go ahead.
Yes. First thing about the PETA story, I've checked their website. They're actually trying to get a petition to get Congress to do that.
And it's to honor the chimps, but to teach NASA not to abuse the animals and others to not do research on animals, right? Something like that, isn't it?
Yes. Peter's proposed memorial would allow NASA to acknowledge its part in this shameful history, including the important role that is the agency's breeding program had in creating a population of captive chimpanzees. Subsequently spent decades being tormented and last law springs are still locked up.
I think we should send PETA people on a one-way mission to Mars.
No, I got another.
They don't deserve Mars.
They don't deserve Mars.
We should send them to Venus.
Send them to Venus.
Yeah, I mean
the atmosphere there is, what, 8,000 miles thick, and it's mostly acid?
Yeah, they probably will be pretty much turned into burnt charcoal by then.
Do you think there's any chance NASA would...
Looking at.
Do you think there's any chance NASA, out of being politically correct, would give them vacant space to do something like that?
Well, I think that they might, and Tim, I didn't mean to jump in here, but I think that NASA might recognize the chimpanzees, which is, there's nothing wrong with that, but they're certainly not going to recognize that they were shamefully mistreated, for crying out loud. These chimpanzees had great lives. Now, of course, they did live captured, that's true. But they had great lives, probably far more greater lives than and chimpanzees elsewhere. But that's animals, you know. You have animals in cages, and you know. I mean, I don't know what to say to these people. I can't communicate with them.
Listeners, I would just urge you to listen to the show with Jay from a couple of years ago, because he tells some of the wildest chimpanzee stories. I mean, you will be on the floor rolling in laughter with some of the stories he tells from these early days, and the chimps featured royally in it. It sounds to me like the chimps were having more fun than the astronauts were having.
Hey, you know, David, the other day I was fortunate to be the MC for John Glenn and Scott Carpenter, and they appeared before about 175 members of their launch team. Most of these guys are out there, you know, like I'm 78, and these guys are like 85, 90, and they're out there in wheelchairs and whatnot. But we just had a great time together, and I was walking around with a mic, and I'm interviewing different people, and this guy said, I turned this wrench, and the other guy said, I did this, and then you could just tell that people were getting a little bored, you know, and it was getting a little dry. And I said, where is Gene Stifel? Well, Gene Stifel was an engineer from McDonnell that was in charge of Friendship 7. And so anyway, he took Friendship 7. He prepared it, took it to the Smithsonian, and flew it up there. And so I said, Gene, where are you? You here? And he stood up. I said, you know, I turned to John Glenn, and I said, hey, John, this is the engineer that took care of Friendship 7 and took it to Smithsonian and all of this and blah, blah, blah. And he said, that's wonderful, you know, and everybody's acknowledging. And I said, when he had Friendship 7 on the plane, I said, every time the plane would bank or something, he'd hear something move about in Friendship 7. And he got real curious what it was, and finally he opened the hatch and he went head first into the bowels of Friendship 7. And he found this thing rolling around in there, and he pulled it out, and it was a half-empty bottle of Jack Daniels. Well, that place roared for about 5 minutes, and John Glenn sat there chuckling, you know, and so did Scott Carpenter. He never said a word. But I was implying, of course, which wrongly, it was all fabricated by me, that he carried along with Jack Daniels as a boost to his courage, you know. And so Scott Carpenter said, he said, I want to say right here and now that as backup to John Glenn, I was in and out of Friendship 7 a lot, but that wasn't my bottle of Jack Daniels, you know.
So we had a little laughter and a little of that. And, of course, that was made up by me right on the spot. There was no bottle of, and I'm sure that'll come back, but there was no bottle of Jack Daniels ever found on board Friendship 7.
Tim, what is your question or comment other than the PETA news?
Yes. What I wanted to address was the whole idea about the SLS. Now, a lot of the opposition to SLS is coming from the propellant depot people. It's not that they don't want missions, but they think that SLS is going to be a detour and a drag on any attempt because it's just simply going to be killed by another administration before it even gets finished, like
that's
so many other programs
scare.
Before.
Tim, that's what I've been talking about. That's the biggest scare.
Yeah,
the biggest scare right there.
Late
and,
because from work.
Yeah, and if we don't, if NASA doesn't continue its job, and its job is to explore, if it doesn't continue its job of exploring and moving on out into space, then we pretty well have it. We've had it because, you know, I think that's right now, that's the only salvation for it. Of course, now I was up. Do you work at Marshall?
I don't work at Marshall.
He's in Huntsville, though.
Yeah, you're in Huntsville, but you don't work at
Marshall. I work in Huntsville as an engineer.
Pardon me?
As an engineer. I work in Huntsville as an engineer.
Oh, you do, but you're not at Marshall.
No, I'm not at Marshall.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because I've been up there. I got a Von Braun Award up there this year and everything. Been up there a couple of times, of course. But I went up there when it was a Redstone Arsenal and everything, when Explorer 1 was put into orbit. And goes back, one of my favorite places. Some great, great people up there you got.
What else, Tim?
I think Tim's gone.
No, I hear him back there, but he's going to be gone unless he speaks up.
Okay. I was trying to remember what was the last question I wanted to ask about. Let's see.
Got you, too.
Oh, yeah. Now, I wanted to say one other thing about the radiation and the moon. Mm-hmm. One good thing about the moon is it's 3 days to get there. And once you land there, you can use lunar regolith for radiation shielding, and you can control how much radiation the astronauts receive by, you know, timing how long they've been out in there out doing EVAs if you get enough regolith on there.
Sure, that's what we were talking about, you know, there earlier at Attican Basin. Once you get there, they got plenty of dirt. You know, they can control it exactly what the heck that they need, and we know that. But again, on the other hand, if we're going to go to an asteroid, and that's several weeks out, you know, we got to carry our own protection. There's no other way that I can see it. You can do it.
Jay, let's testify before Congress that we want them to pay for our own protection. How's that?
Okay. Hey, oh, by the way, your guest coming in on Wednesday, I believe it's Tyson DeGrasse.
No, he's coming tomorrow. He's coming tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yeah. He actually did a special on NOVA about trips to Mars and the effects of radiation, and he actually went over tests done on rats and the effects radiation had on them.
Ah. Are you going to have him on tomorrow, David?
Yeah, 1 p.m. California time, 4 p.m.
I'm his biggest fan.
Does he know you? Do you know him?
Oh, yeah. He came by the last time I saw him. He came walking by my studio, the NBC building out on the press side. You know, and I yell, "My favorite astronomer!" You know, and he went by.
I'll be
way back, but I've talked to him before, and then I gave him for his American Museum of History and all up there. I gave him I forget what it was. It was something that went to the moon that I had.
Well,
I just think that guy is the greatest.
Yeah, this will be the third time he's been a guest on the show. So.
I mean, he is just magnificent. I'm a big fan of his. You know, big fan.
Yeah.
Are you talking about smart people a while ago? I wish I just had one grain of his smarts. He's so smart that he knows what the heck is going on.
Absolutely.
And you know, he's a nice guy. This is the thing. He's a nice guy.
Very nice, not pretentious or anything. No. And Tim, I'm going to take you off in case someone else wants the line.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, take care, Tim. Thanks for calling.
you got another email. Terry in Corpus Christi says, please ask Jay that with all the budget cuts, what do you think of the future for manned space flight with NASA as well as commercial? Also, are you optimistic that SpaceX will get their act together and actually fly somewhat on whatever schedule happens to be their schedule?
Well, who was it, Kelly?
Terry, but I also added a little bit to it for him.
Okay, Terry. They had a real a fueling test of their Falcon 9 rocket here the other day that went great. Okay?
Uh-huh.
So everything is indicating that they probably will get off the ground if NASA is ready for them. Get off the ground late April. And we're hoping they will. Now, I think SpaceX is doing pretty well. I think that they've got their act pretty well together. And I think the other one, their biggest competitor is going to be Boeing Company, the CST-100. And that's going to go up on the Atlas V. I don't know about the other two. I don't know what Sierra Nevada is doing. I really don't know how the other two are coming along on that. But I think that we're going to get action, you know, out of SpaceX in low Earth orbit. I think it's going to come along, and I think maybe now 2017 they'll go up and get that plaque on the door that was left up there by the astronauts. And it'll either be SpaceX or it'll either be Boeing CST-100 on top of an Atlas V. But they're good people in both companies, and they're doing well. And there's a place for them for low Earth orbit, and there's nothing wrong with it. The only problem people don't seem to realize that NASA's only going to have a couple of flights for them a year. So they're going to have to build up other flights. They're going to have to get business elsewhere, and which I'm sure that they can. But it is equally important that SLS gets going, and it is not canceled by another
Congress or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be canceled by Congress. I think it would be canceled by another administration. I would tell you, I think if a person gets in there that they think they got to stop all spending and there'll be no jobs for anybody, then and I tell you, the people who think they want this, they're going to be sadly surprised when all of their family and all are walking up and down looking for jobs, trying to make a living. They don't know what hard times are like. I was born in the Depression. They don't know what hard times are like until they can't get a job and their family can't get a job and all. So that's the reason I'm saying naturally spending has to be brought under control, but it should be brought under control gradually instead of with a meat axe. And this is what worries me more than anything. If somebody gets in there and they turn around and they say, well, we'll turn it over to commercial. Well, commercial can't handle this.
Well, that's what they've already done. They've turned over the human spaceflight portion to commercial.
Well, they've turned over low Earth orbit. You see, this is the key. All we've been doing with shuttle is just going. Shuttle couldn't go any higher than 300 miles.
Right.
All we've been doing is just going back and forth to the space station. So they're going to be space taxes, and that's okay. And if they can get other things, because what we really need is we need to get back into space exploration and less explore space.
Amen.
Okay? Let's go out to the asteroids. Let's learn how to travel, because you've got to remember one simple fact. We're living on a spacecraft that's 8,000 miles in diameter, and it's our cradle. This is where we were born, and you can't live in a cradle forever. You've got to be able to go and move, and if the human species is going to survive, it first of all came on board in Africa, and then after 100,000 years began to move out of that continent as hunter-gatherers and moved all over and developed races all over the planet. Well, the planet is populated, so we got to go populate the moon. We got to go to other planets. There's so many things that we have to do, and the only way that we're going to continue to do this is to explore, and the only way that you're going to grow is through knowledge. And all the knowledge that the space program has given us, especially in the medical field,
is fantastic. I think most people don't realize it. When Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon in Apollo 11, there are more computation power, more computer in just a laptop than all the computers they had on board the Apollo 11 that you have there today, that has been developed out of it, and the technology of where we are. Do people think that if we stop this, that this technology is going to continue? It's going to continue at a very slow rate. I've had scientists tell me that people don't realize, had we not had a space program, had we not gone to the moon, that we would be 50 years behind where we are in technology today. It would have developed that slowly. And you're going to go back to this again today? There are unfortunately people on this planet who think that the time they're born, that they everything must be given to them, that they're entitled to it. But who's going to develop? Where are the visionaries? Who's going to develop what we need out there? Who's going to keep the stockpile of knowledge growing? It's got to happen. Otherwise, what's going to happen to the human race? We're going to die. Well, that's our fate predicted for fate anyway, and probably would happen. We'll probably live a couple of 100,000 years. We might live another 50 or 100,000 years. We're gone. What else takes over? I don't know, you know. But if we want to survive, by golly, we better keep learning. We better keep exploring. We better keep building. And we better do this with a little smarts rather than jumping from one side of the coin to another side of the coin.
Absolutely.
Have an opinion.
listeners, a few minutes ago, I gave a question from Andrew. It was really a question from Jim in California. I apologize for that. And you have another caller. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Okay, go ahead, Terry.
Yeah, Jay, I appreciate you answering my last question that I emailed in.
Okay.
Followed you ever since Sputnik, so you're one of my favorite people in the space business.
God bless you, Terry. You need your house painted. How about a new car?
Well, yeah, both.
Okay.
Specifically, what I've enjoyed in the past is when the shuttle was flying and they had the conferences with all the NASA mucky mucks. You and Todd Halverson, I always perked up when y'all answered questions because I knew you were going to ask the real pointed, real tough questions. So I always enjoy that. And you ought to get Todd on the space show someday.
I've been trying.
Well, hey, I'll help you. Todd's my buddy.
Okay, well,
he's a great guy.
Well,
he really is.
He said he'd get back to me, and I'm still waiting.
Well, you call him up and you tell him that Jay Barbary says that he's going to take you and your daughters out of his will if you don't come on my program.
I will do so, okay.
Hey, yeah, just tell him that. Terry in Corpus Christi and Jay wants you to come on.
Okay, I wrote it down so I could tell him.
Yeah, that Jay is taking him and his daughters out of his will, you know.
Okay. What else?
Good guess.
What, Terry?
Don't you think that Todd would be a good guess?
Terry, are you on a different kind of phone today? This is really horrible.
Oh, is it horrible?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you're breaking up, Terry.
I'll try to call back.
Well, go ahead. You got another email from Jerry who called in from Merritt Island a little while ago because
that's where I'm sitting right now.
Oh, really? You probably
can. Sure, I live on Merritt Island. Yes.
Okay, you and all the alligators, right?
All right.
Because the Dragon capsule is essentially the same as the Cargo Dragon, SpaceX can amortize the manned Dragon as one of many launches a year in terms of actual launch costs. The CTS-100 needs all four manned flights a year to cost itself out. So
yeah.
That's what Jerry says.
Well, Jerry's probably right. He's probably right. You know, I don't know that close. I'm just talking about the spacecraft being ready. But I know SpaceX's intention is to do the cargo and then turn it in and, of course, use it for astronauts, you know, for human flight.
Absolutely. So are you optimistic that our human space flight program will get its legs back and start flying soon and doing things?
If the politicians leave it alone. This is my whole point. If we go, you know, I'm not going to tell you I'm in favor of President Obama being reelected or Mitt Romney being elected or Newt Gingrich being elected. I'm not going to tell you that because, you know, I try to stay out of it and be independent. But I researched for two stories I did for MSNBC that are on there right now. I researched everybody within NASA. And the way it is set up now with the SLS program and the commercial program, if President Obama is reelected, that's the way it's going to go. It's going to continue for another 4 years, okay? If another person is elected, and that's up to the American people, that's certainly not up to Jay Barbary. If it is, if that person is smart enough, and of all of them that I've interviewed, the only one I think is smart enough is Gingrich. The program will continue. I think the others are just simply indifferent to the space program and know very little about it and could care very little about it. And when you have a situation like that, the answer politically is we'll have a committee study it. Well, all of these committees that studied space, I've never seen one of these clowns here.
Well,
now,
you know,
the only one that was ever here was Sally Ride on this last commission that I knew of. I don't know where they get these people. I think they go out and pick people that they know are going to vote the way they want them to vote. If they want the space program canceled, then they won't come up and say we should cancel it. We'll have it studied by an elite committee. And they bring these people out, and everybody that's appointed to that committee will vote the way they want them to vote. And they'll study it to death for 2 years, and they come up with the commission report. You know? And they talk about George Bush canceling the shuttle program. Well, we had an accident with a shuttle called Columbia that we lost in February 2nd, 2003, if my memory sticks in my mind right. Well, the commission that studied it said that the space shuttle was inherently dangerous, and as soon as the space station was completed, it should be canceled. Well, George W. Bush, President of the United States, followed that. But at the time, they had a program called Constellation. And Constellation was supposed to be ready to fly within a year after the last shuttle did. And they went ahead, the Obama administration went ahead and canceled it, primarily because the funds were never there for Constellation. They all voted on it, but they never funded it. It wasn't there. So now you got no program out there at all. John Glenn went to President Obama's office and begged him to keep shuttle going. Well, what we could have done, and I wrote about this and talked about this, is that we could have kept several space shuttles in the barn, flown one a year. We had the tanks, we had the solids, we had everything that we needed to fly them, and we could have spaced them out over 3 or 4 years. And you wouldn't be in a situation that if you have a failure of the Soyuz, that you have no way of getting up there, or if you have to get up there for some reason and you have to boost the station into a higher orbit, that your ATVs and Progress and all of that in its own system can do today, you were not out of the business. But they said, well, it's going to cost so much to keep the infrastructure in place. So keep the infrastructure in place. What people don't realize, NASA's budget has not been increased. The question is here is what do you spend it on? And they were spending the money somewhere on quite a few other things. They could have spent the money on keeping the shuttle in place for another 3 or 4 years till we got closer to having SpaceX's
a spacecraft ready to fly, or Boeing's CST-100.
Well, that dog has already left for the races, so I agree with you completely, but it didn't happen. A lot of people wanted that to happen.
Of course.
You know, it was the only rational thing to do.
Yeah. Now let's try to go to a museum and fly one of them.
yeah, absolutely. Listen, we may have to do that if the Russians keep taking their Soyuz offline.
No, what's going to happen is we're going to have to wait on the CST-100. We got the Orion, you know, going along. I'm going to go out there for it on Thursday, and we've got SpaceX. So that's what we need. I tell you, right now, a lot of people have criticized SpaceX, criticized other things, but what Elon Musk has done on his own a lot is that he's standing there, and he might just be the only guy guarding the hen house right now. So we need him. We need the CST-100. We need all of this, you know, so... Let's get her going, guys. Let's all pull together and pull in the same direction.
Do you see that we're going to come out of this in 2012, 2013, and still have our leadership position in space, or are we going to be overtaken?
Well, we can very easily if it's not messed with.
Well, it is being messed with.
Well, this is what I'm talking about. If Congress funds it. This is the thing. See, you got SLS set up there now, but what if they don't fund it?
Well, they may not.
That's what I'm telling you, see? But if they do it, then, yeah, we're fine. We can do this thing because Charlie Bolden, NASA administrator, walked into this room, stumped in with his combat boots on, stumped into the room and says, enough of this yak, yak, yak for 3 years. We're going to use what we know works, what we have. And then there they go. They start putting the SLS together. They started saving the engines from the shuttle. They started the solids and everything else. But still, the solids is only, they only bought the solid boosters for the SLS for two flights. Because you've got Aerojet pushing like mad to use liquid engines. And after you had 200, and I'd have to figure it up again, I think it was 214 solid boosters for the shuttle flew without a problem. And they have done this five-segment stage, and it flew in Aries 1. And they've had two ground tests of it, and it works. Yet... Change horses, change horses, change horses. Why? Oh, those solid rockets, they're rough riders. They shake the thing. Oh, you mean you want to make it an easier ride for the astronauts? I have never heard an astronaut complain about the ride.
Neither have I.
All of a sudden it's too rough for him? You got to have liquid?
Well, Aerojet also makes solids and wanted to bid on that contract too. Didn't want it all going to ATK.
I don't care who gets the contract. I just say let's go with what works. I got no stock in any of these companies. I'm not on their payrolls. Especially now that my daughter doesn't have a job. You know. We don't have no jobs down here. So, I mean, I'm not pushing for anybody to get any specific company to get a contract.
What's the mood of the Space Coast? Is it upbeat? Is it really down? What can you say about
the
mood?
Well, the Space family is sort of down, and I don't think that they, again, the people realize in the area, David, I don't think they realize what's going to happen. You know, if somebody comes in as president of the United States that is indifferent to space, I don't think they realize what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is very simple. They're going to say, I'm forming a blue ribbon committee that's going to study the program. And they're going to start studying, and they're probably going to wind up giving some stuff to for the space station to the commercial people. and SLS is going to go away, and everything else is going to go away, and they're going to transfer funds that would have been for NASA to what is it, education or some other pet project that they have. Maybe they'll give it to PETA. So I don't think they realize this. So that's the reason why I went back, and I went all the way through NASA, all the way down. Does the Obama administration anticipate there will be a need for more studies? No, been there, done that. This is what Congress and this is what the administration has agreed on, and the OMB has blessed it. Office of Management Budget, that's the key. That's the guys who hadn't turned along. We're all in the same step.
But, you know, Romney has this panel advising him and of people who really do know space. Mike is on that, and Scott is on that. And
who is on
Mike Griffin is on the panel. And,
Scott
Pace is on the panel. You know him, too. And Eric Anderson from Space Adventures is on it, and I forget who the other one is.
Well, we'll ask Mike Griffin and those guys that's on that panel, what is Romney going to do if he's elected?
Well, I'm working on bringing Scott back to the program,
okay.
And I will ask him that.
Tell me
if he is able to, you know, to say
yeah,
it.
What,
I don't
what
know.
What is Romney going to do if he's elected? Is he going to give us another committee to study it?
I hope not.
You
but
know,
but I
what
think
is
they all
do. This is what we've been fighting for 3 or 4 years. All these different little groups fighting one another.
Yeah. Now look, I think Romney at least cared enough about space to form a Blue Ribbon committee to advise him. Santorum has nobody advising him about space. I don't know what his Senate record was.
He's indifferent.
But he probably could care less. And Ron Paul, who probably doesn't have a prayer in hell, says NASA wasn't in the Constitution. And,
all he wants is defense. He built the rocket for defense. That's all he cares about. That's Ron Paul I'm talking about. So go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's about all I have to say about him. And and then there's Newt, who unfortunately put forth his space policy in a really bad way.
Yeah, he did. He actually did. He gave him room to laugh at him.
Yeah. And
Romney called him zany. And this is what I'm talking about. But I would love to know. So you ask Scott, you ask Mike Griffin, you ask any of these guys that's on his advisory council or his commission or whatever, what is it that he intends? But I'll bet you they can't tell you. I really bet you they can't tell you. Now, you got people on there that probably want to go change things around again. And they do. They're just going to slow everything down. They're not going to get it going. Now, I know. I talked to some of the Apollo astronauts. They're good friends of mine. And they talk about it, and I know they're not happy with what's happened here. They're not happy with SLS the way it is. They would like to go back and spend billions of dollars on space program, you know, again. But they're not going to get it.
No way, yeah.
There's no way that they're going to get it. So what you do is when you got something that is workable, that has been through the fires, and it comes out like SLS, and the commercial people now have the good sense to go with it.
Because you
start tearing this thing apart again, you're not going to put the pieces back together.
And
I don't see how in the world that Romney cares that much and he's going to put the pieces back together again.
Well, and your friend Neil deGrasse Tyson is calling for doubling the NASA budget, going from half of 1% to 1% of the NASA
Neil
budget.
He's a great guy.
He holds
he's
up a penny.
Absolutely right, but it's not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
Yeah,
and yeah, he is right.
Yeah, so what I'm saying is let's be realistic. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying let's be realistic because things will change in 10 years. If you can get SLS started now, if you can get it going, if you can get the budget they're going now and all, these things can happen, you see. But it's just like
space shuttle went so long, everybody came in, didn't want to help it, but they didn't want to cancel it. So it kept trucking along, you know, and nobody talked about space. You see, and then Bush came out and he started talking about we're going to go back to the moon and blah, 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 and all this stuff. Hey, everybody's applauding, but there's no funds.
No funds for it.
Yeah, you know. So what I'm saying is that if you got something and you can keep it going, you know, let's keep it going, because SLS you can build on. SLS you can change as you need it. And what is SLS? It's beyond LEO, low Earth orbit. That's all. Build those horses that can take you beyond low Earth orbit, and you got something. And don't try to do the whole thing yourself. Bring in your friends, the European Space Agency, all of them. Get them involved in it. They all got a little piece of the pie. They all want to take a little pride in it. We're going to Mars. And the guy saying we're going to Mars is the guy that might build one little flinge that goes on one little thing. You know, but he's part of it. You know, he's going to Mars. And so I don't know. I'm a big fan of Mike Griffin. Mike Griffin was the NASA administrator who gave me the highest medal that NASA has. I think I'm the only reporter that's ever gotten it. But I believe in Mike Griffin. I think he is the smartest man in any room he walks into.
Well, he wants to be administrator again if a Republican wins.
Good. I'd be right there. I'll polish his desk. You know what I'm saying? I'm just saying, let's be realistic. You know, and if the Republican wins, maybe Mike will be administrator again. I don't know. Whatever Mike wants, I'm for Mike. Mike, to me, will always be a great guy in every way and everything like that. But, I mean, I think probably the greatest guy ever that this country has to, and I really don't want to say ever, I've got to be a couple of other ones right there with him, is Neil Armstrong. Now, Neil, we could not have picked a better person to have been the first to step on the moon than Neil Armstrong. He is just a wonderful, non-assuming person.
You know, I just met him for the first time last week. He was at the suborbital conference in Palo Alto, California. He was a keynote, and I was able to meet him and talk to him for a few minutes.
Good.
Quite a friendly, just an incredible human being.
He's a wonderful person.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful person. You have never seen Neil Armstrong advance his wealth or anything for being the first guy to walk on the moon. Now, I got him to introduce moonshot. He finally did do a book, First Man, you know, but I got him to introduce moonshot. And he and the other guys asked me to come up and be the keynote speaker at Cleveland for the 50th anniversary. He and John Glenn and all of them, I went up there and did that for him. NBC gave me a 50th anniversary dinner down here at the Debus hall and everything out of the space, and they said you can invite three astronauts. I invited Neil Armstrong, John Glenn, and Edgar Mitchell, who walked on the moon with my buddy Alan Shepard, and they all three came. And so anyway, Neil never goes anywhere. He hardly ever goes
absolutely anywhere. Yeah,
and but anyway, there is no better person than Neil or John Glenn or any of these guys that's been there. And I would dearly love to see them get their wishes. But they're not going to get them. It's not going to happen. So what we've got to hold on to when we won't even have that.
We have been talking for an hour and 42 minutes without a break.
I'm sending you a bill for overtime.
I'll just pass it on to Alan Boyle over at MSNBC and tell him to squash it in the company.
They will. They will. Well, believe me.
What do you want to say in conclusion or to leave with us today?
Well, I'd like for people to know that Moonshot, which was a New York Times bestseller, and it's one of the few things, you know, great things in my life. It gives me the legitimate opportunity to say I'm a New York Times bestseller. It's back on
all of your websites, and you can buy it, but it's updated. And today I spent a year updating it, and all for Alan's girls and for Deke's son, Kent. And so we got it out there, and if you'd like to get the latest copy of Moonshot, it's on your web. Go buy it. And help out all of Alan's grandchildren, you know. But it's a good book, and I hope it's a good read. We worked real hard on it. I wasn't the only one. And as I say when I sign something, I say, I hope you find live a good read. If not, it's my wife's fault. She helped.
blame it on her, right?
Yeah, right. And we've only been married 52 years and never left one another even for one night in those 52 years. So she's a pretty good gal. I just hope I'm one-tenth the husband she is the wife to me.
Is she a space cadet like you are?
Well, I don't. She came here. It is funny, David. I was Mobile Mike first when I came here. I went out and was doing traffic reports of the missile workers coming back and forth. And so at the radio station I was at, this was 2 weeks before I went to work for NBC on July 21st, 1958. So this is July 4th, 1958. I drove a young lady on the back of our convertible, the station's convertible, to the Miss Brevard Beauty Contest. Now, Brevard is the name of our county.
Right.
Brevard County, Florida. So it was down at Old Galley Park on the Indian River, and I get down there, and there's about 60 entries, and this little 16-year-old girl named Jo Reisinger, she won it. And I had to learn how to pronounce her last name. And then I covered a couple of other beauty contests, and she won those, and I was dating the Miss Florida 1958, Deanie Cates, up at Daytona, because she did a space show for our affiliate, WESH, and so Deanie is a wonderful lady, and I was dating her, and then I started dating Joe. And so I'm dating these two beauty queens, and finally I had to make a choice, and I like to tell them the only reason that I chose to stay with Joe was that I hated doing that hour-and-a-half drive to Daytona Beach. But anyway, Deanie, because you see, they both had come to realize that I was no catch, and I knew they both were great catches. So I had to focus on catching one of them, you know.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, Deanie married a orthopedic surgeon and has four wonderful sons, and she was elected election supervisor two terms for Volusia County, where Daytona Beach is. And Joe, she married me on September the 3rd, 1960, and she's been the mother of our children and grandchildren and everything like that, and just been the greatest person in the world. And I've been selfish. It's all been my career and everything like that. And she's never had a career, except I try to make her feel like that, you know, that she's a big cog in my 54 years with NBC here. In fact, NBC bought her like four dozen red roses the night that they gave me the dinner, you know, and everything. But when you get lucky on something like I got so lucky on my wife, David, you better realize that. I better hold on to it, because you look around, there are not too many people that's going to spend 54 years, 52 years with one another.
You know,
54 years with NBC, 52 years with my wife, Joe.
You know, I left a caller on hold, and I forgot to bring him up on air. Caller, are you still with us? Did you get off? Hello? I think I screwed the guy over.
Oh, God bless him.
Well,
whatever.
I apologize if you're still listening. That one is on me. Jay, until the next time, what's your big project? What are you working on?
Well, I'm working on a series, Getting to Mars. It's on MSNBC.com, science page. So about every three or four weeks, I have something out there with that. And covering, like, going out and covering Orion now, and I'll be covering, hopefully, end of April, I'll be covering the launch of Dragon to the space station. That's our next big thing here. And we've got, of course, Curiosity on its way to Mars. And its landing will be taking place in August, and anything happening on the space station. And as NBC says, you never know in this business if something should happen up there. They should get hit by a piece of space junk
heaven forbid, or anything like that. You might need somebody that kind of knows what's going on up there. I don't know how much I know, but I've been around to see most of it, so maybe a little of it rubbed off on me. Yeah.
Well, they'll send you up there to rescue them.
Oh, yes. I don't think they got enough people to do that. I came in, you know, when they had the Journalists in Space program back. It ended right after Challenger, but I made it into the semifinalist, you know, and it got canceled. But I don't think I'd go today. I mean, I think I'm 78 years old, but I'm in great shape. I walk on a treadmill every day for over two miles, and I do other workouts that keeps my balance and flexibility, and I feel like I'm in my 30s, and I think that that is the answer to, I just got through helping a young lady do a thing. It's going to be on MSNBC website called Going Old Must You, and what we need to do today to save young. And, you know, supposedly Ponce de Leon really stepped on to Florida, right down just a few miles south of me here in the shadows of the rocket gantries. And if he stepped there today and found all these fitness centers going, because in the 16th century, the average life expectancy was late 30s, early 40s. And if he did today, he'd find 80 and 90-year-olds working out in the fitness centers. So I think he'd find his fountain of youth, you know, right here today. But basically, that's what I do. I try to take care of myself, David, and, you know, continue, because we finally fly some people back to the space station or go to an asteroid or something. I'd kind of like to be hanging around.
I don't blame you. I would, too.
Yeah.
Jay, thank you a lot for being with us today, and let's do this again down the road. You're a lot of fun and really interesting guy, and you have a lot to teach us and to share with us.
Well, thank you so much, David. You're a kind person, and give me a call if you need me.
Absolutely.
Okay?
And that's it for today. Special thanks to Jay Barbary. And tomorrow, 1 p.m. California time, 4 p.m. New York time, Dr. Neil deGrasse Tyson is with us for 1 hour. I get him longer than John Stewart got him. How about that?
That's great.
Thank you all for listening to today's Space Show. Goodbye.